And who might that have been?
What?
The other seemed taken aback.
But you know Weller now? I speak of the abominable wealthy one who disguised himself with pustules and was companion to Ferenc. Why, time and again he urged that grotesque giant to seek you out and murder you.
Scythus nodded.
Well, that would be Vols's way, sure enough. I was never a favourite of his, nor he of mine, the monstrous clown. If his wens had been his wits, he'd have outshone the lot of us.
So it was your beast that killed him, eh?
Of course, of course.
Shaitan's mental voice sank deeper and darker yet.
And do you think I could not kill you too? Ah, I could, my son, I could, but will not.
His tone was light again in a moment.
No, for I sense that we'll do well together. And since in various ways I've already shown my goodwill, the next stage is up to you.
Stage? Scythus frowned. What stage is that?
Of the plan,
Shaitan explained.
Or would you have me do it all and likewise claim all the credit?
Explain.
But there's nothing to explain. Just go along with it in accordance with your own plan, exactly as planned, and that will suffice. In short, bring them to me, my son, so that I may deal with them in my way.
Fess and the leper's son? And will you kill them? And then me too, perhaps? Maybe I do better to stay joined with them against you. Better the devil you know, they say.
And after long moments,
devil? That's a word I don't much care for,
said Shaitan.
I don't know why, but I don't like it. Be advised not to call me that again, not even obliquely.
Scythus shrugged. As you will. And before he could say or ask any more,
they are waking up,
Shaitan hissed.
The squat one and the giant both. Best I leave now and not compromise you. Only bring them to me, Scythus. A great deal depends on it.
And as suddenly as that, Scythus's mind was free of outside interference, but only just in time.
Scythus? The pharynx's rumble echoed in the cold air. I sense that you're awake. Ha! It's a bad conscience makes a man restless as you. You'll have to mend your ways.
And he laughed uproariously. The ice castle shuddered and sent down a cascade of variously sized icicles, which in turn brought Arcus more fully awake. Scratching himself, the leper's son sat up.
What's all the noise? He demanded.
Time you were up,
Scythus called across to him.
No more delays. We make our breakfast, poor fare that it is, and then we're on our way. What or whoever the volcano house is, he's our meat today, and all his goods in the bargain.
Good talk, Scythus, the other answered, but we've to get past the pale cavern-dweller blood beast first.
Three of us this time, said Scythus. And forewarned is forearmed. Anyway, Fess knows the beast's lair. We'll give it a wide berth and seek some other way in.
The pharynx chewed on cold meat and made his way down to the floor of the hall.
I, for one, am ready for it, he said. A man can't live forever, not even a lord of the Vampiri. Not that we've seen, anyway, and I'm damned if I'll die of boredom or locked in ice, terrified that something will find me there and dig me out.
Oh, Scythus kept his thoughts guarded. Not live forever? Well, perhaps not. But close enough, if Shaitan is anything to go by. And wouldn't that in itself be sufficient reason to team up with the Ancient? To discover the secrets of his longevity? It surely would.
As for Arcus and Ferenc, Scythus knew that sooner or later he'd be obliged to have it out with them anyway, so why delay matters? And even better if Shaitan desired to have a hand in it. With these thoughts and others like them in his mind, but always guarded, especially thoughts such as these, Scythus joined the others where they prepared to leave the ice castle. And a short time later, the three set out upon their long, slow climb up the frozen rise to where the central cone jutted some 1,500 feet higher still. Like a black, crouching giant, the tower of volcanic rock waited for them, sombre under its canopy of cold stars and writhing auroral fire. Shaitan's miniature albino bats accompanied them, almost invisible against the snow and ice glare, forming an endless entourage whose members came and went, reporting all back to their immemorial master. In this way he was kept informed of the progress of the three, and was pleased to note that they followed a most admirable route, one which would lead them directly into one of his many man-traps. An ambush, aye, except that this time there would be no killing. No, for there were other better things to do with men such as Fesferenc and Arcus Leperson than kill them. What? Good, strong, vampiry flesh, such as theirs? And they had their vampires in them, didn't they? Just as Vols Piniscu had once had his in him. Ah, but that had been a treat. Vols had been monstrous on the outside right enough, with all of his pimples, polyps, and other excrescences, but just half an inch under his welky skin there had been a mass of fatty tissues and good, strong, long pig meat hanging on a frame of bones like any other man. Except because he was Vampiri, there was a lot more to him than there was to other men, for deep inside him there was also his vampire. So that after Shaitan's ingurgitator had drained him of his blood and dragged the shattered shell of him before its master, what sheer delight! To tear open Vols's pallid body and seek out his leech, the living vampire whose squirming had so cleverly avoided the ingurgitator's siphon-like probe, but which could not avoid Shaitan, and finally to behead the thing and gorge on its nectar fluids, having first scooped up its skittering egg and stored it in a jar of Vols's brains, mushed to a paste, as a titbit for later. Ah, yes, for to the Vampiri such is the essence of a gourmet feast. Even then Shaitan had not been quite finished with his victim, for extracts of Vols's flesh, which was infected with vampire metamorphosism, and so not entirely dead even now, would be useful to him in his experimentation, the creation of hybrid creatures such as the ingurgitator and other useful constructs, to which ends the flayed, drained, gutted, decapitated, but nonetheless living remains of Vols had been stored with Shaitan's other materials, for use later. Aye, even as the giant Ferenx and the squat Arcus Leperson's remains would be stored, if all went according to plan. But as for Shaitha's, well, there are plans and there are plans. Shaitha's was of the blood, of Shaitan's blood, and of all the Vampiri who had been, he was also beautiful. Not by human standards, no, but certainly by Shaitan's. Beautiful, strong, vibrant with life. Ah, but then the blood is the life. And when Shaitan dwelled on matters such as these, then he, no less than his wily descendant, kept his thoughts well hidden. Meanwhile, his small albinos continued to apprise him of the trio's progress. In a little while he saw that they strayed from the path somewhat, so that he must needs redirect them. But in order to do that he must first contact Shaitha's, who at that very moment toiled halfway up the fused volcanic slag cliffs towards the western face of the cone. The other two were within hailing distance, but their minds were concentrated on the task in hand. Shaitan aimed a narrow, powerful beam of thoughts directly into Shaitha's mind, with which he was now a little better acquainted.
"Son of my sons," he said, "you go somewhat astray. Your route requires some small adjustment."
Shaitha's was momentarily startled, but quickly controlled the agitated flutters of his thoughts. Not before Fesferenc had sensed something, however. "What?" Fess called out across the precipitous, naked rock face. "Did something alarm you just then, Shaitha's?"
"My foot slipped on a patch of ice," Shaitha's lied. "It's a long way down. If I had fallen, I was gearing myself for metamorphosis."
The Ferenc nodded across the gulf.
"Aye, we grow weak. Upon a time I'd revel in forming an air-shape and flying from these heights. Now it would deplete me considerably. We must watch how we go."
Now Shaitha's could answer his ancestor's inquiry, but he must do so carefully, with all of his effort concentrated on keeping his telepathic sendings private. To this end he made himself secure on a small ledge before answering.
Shaitan, you almost gave me away then. Now tell me, how do we stray from the path, and how may I correct it? Also, you'd better tell me what to expect. I've no desire to end up pierced to the heart and drained off like Volspinescu.
Fool,
the other at once hissed.
I thought we had had that out. If I wanted you dead, you would be dead. I could send a creature even now to buffet you all three from the face of the cliff. Perhaps you'd fly and perhaps not. Whichever, you'd be depleted, and my creatures would find you and finish it. But I need you, Shivers. We need each other, and so you live. As for the others, I do not wish to damage them. I want them whole. Can't you see what a fine pair of warriors, Arcus and Ferenc, would make?
Shaitan's words were so ominous he could only be speaking truth. He would not dare boast of such superiority unless he could deliver it. It was in effect an ultimatum, even a threat. Make up your mind, join me now or suffer the consequences. In answer to which,
very well, said Shaitas, we work together. Tell me what to do.
Without pause, Shaitan explained.
The leper's son climbs too far towards the east, diagonally away from you. In his way lies an old unguarded lava run which leads directly to my rooms at the volcano's core. If Arcus were to discover the mouth of this cave, he could jeopardize my position. Certainly my plans would require rapid and radical alteration.
An unguarded entrance? Careless of you.
My resources are not unlimited. No more talk. You must draw the others, especially Arcus, back towards you.
Very well, said Shaithas,
and to the others out loud,
Arcus, Fess, we're too far apart, and I sense a problem to the east.
Arcus at once secured himself in a lava niche and peered out and about.
The problem, he blustered. I'm close by, you say? Huh, I sense nothing.
But his voice was full of nervous tension, and his thoughts went this way and that. The Ferenc, closer to Shaithas by some 50 feet, began to edge towards him.
Something has bothered me all along, he said. I've had my suspicions anyway, and you're right, Shaithas. Spread out like this, we're too easy to pick off.
But I see and feel nothing,
Arcus again protested, like a man whistling in the dark. With a shrug in his voice, Shaithas called out to him.
Are you saying that your vampiric awareness is stronger than both of ours combined? Then by all means, let's test it out. Do as you will. Be the master of your own destiny. At least you were warned.
That was enough. Arcus started climbing more to the left, bringing himself back into line on a course converging with the others. And not a moment too soon, for Shaithas, from his own position, had finally spotted the dark shadow of a cave to Arcus's right and a little above him. By now, the leper's son would certainly have come across it. In Shaithas's mind, the dark thoughts of his ancestor came a little easier.
Good. The problem was not insurmountable, but the easy way is usually the best. What now?
Shaithas inquired of him.
Above you is a wide ledge formed of an earlier cone,
Shaitan answered.
When you strike it, move to the left, that is, westward. Soon you will come across another lava run. Ignore it and carry on. The next entrance will seem like a mere crack, occasioned as the rock cooled. But this is your route into the volcano, except you should take up a position to the rear of the others. Do I make myself plain?
Shaithas shivered, perhaps a little from the numbing cold, which was beginning to bite even into his vampiric bones, but mainly at what was implied, for thoughts like speech often lend themselves to diverse interpretation. And certainly he detected the ominous tone of the other's slyly insinuating mental voice. Yes, and he'd known that the depth of Shaitan's thoughts did not bear plumbing. It was strange to be vampiric and yet feel something of awe at the implied evil in another's scheming.
Shaitan,
he eventually cautiously answered,
I'm putting my trust in you. It seems my future is now in your hands.
And mine in yours,
said the other.
Now continue to guard your thoughts and concentrate on your climbing.
And he was gone again. Shaithas suddenly found himself wondering at the wisdom of this dark liaison. Indeed, there seemed little of wisdom in it. It was mainly a matter of instinct and, of course, necessity. But any advantage was Shaitan's. This was his territory, and he knew it well, and he was not without resources. Shaithas could only hope that the ancients' plans for the Ferenc and Arcus Leperson did not extend to him also, but he sensed that they did not. Not for now, anyway. His Vampiri instinct again, which had seldom let him down, but there's always a first time. And a last. He avoided morbid conjecture and looked for brighter omens. Of course, there was always his dream. The first dream of the Lady Karanziri, where he had been returned to power after some fabulous conquest of Starside and the destruction of the Dweller's Garden. He had the feeling that as dreams go, there had been an element of foretokening to it, except there was an old Vampiri maxim that men should never read the future too closely, for to do so is to tempt destiny. And anyway, the dream had ended in disaster and ruin. But at least it had hinted that there was, in fact, a future to look forward to. How much of one was anyone's guess?
A ledge,
Fess Ferenc grunted, dragging himself up ahead of Shaithas. As Shaithas's face appeared level with the rim, the giant reached down a huge taloned hand. Shaithas looked at it for several long moments, then took it, and the Ferenc hauled him easily up onto the level surface.
Last time you had the chance, you threw me down, Shaithas reminded him.
Last time you were reaching for your gauntlet,
the giant replied. Then Arcus came up and joined them.
You and your premonitions, he grumbled. I still say I sense nothing harmful. Also, I believe I was almost into some sort of cave. It might well have been a tunnel.
But Shaithas said,
Oh, and an empty cave, do you think? Or did it perhaps contain one of Fess's sword snouts? Wouldn't I have sensed it?
Arcus frowned. Fess Ferenc scowled.
Vals didn't, he said. Nor did I until it was too late.
And turning to Shaithas,
What now?
Shaithas narrowed his scarlet eyes and made a small show of sniffing the air with his flattened, convoluted snout.
The area to the right still feels dangerous to me, he said. So I vote we follow this rim to the left a while, out of the suspect region. We'll see where it leads. At least it will give us a breather from all this climbing.
The Ferenc nodded his grotesque head.
Suits me. But how we've come down in the world, eh?
As they set off along the ledge, Arcus said,
Come down? How so?
The Ferenc shrugged.
Just look at us. Three lords or ex-lords of the Vampiri, stripped of most of our powers, going like frightened children in a huddled group to explore strange new regions, and afraid of what might jump out on us.
Afraid?
Arcus puffed himself up.
Speak for yourself.
The Ferenc sighed and said simply,
But I saw the thing that lanced the great boil, remember?
At that moment he grew darker, and the three paused to glance speculatively, apprehensively at each other. A thin cloud layer had drifted in to cover the higher reaches of the cone. The first small flakes of snow began to drift down and coat the ledge. Arcus looked at the sky all about.
One cloud?
He voiced his thoughts out loud.
Which just happened to form here? A vampire mist, you think?
Obviously, said the Ferenc. Whoever dwells here, he'd sense us coming and seek to make it harder for us. He makes his lair more obscure and the way to it more difficult.
Which means we're on the right track, Shaithas added.
He set off again along the ledge, and behind him the others almost automatically followed on.
Huh, Arcus grunted. Well, at least your premonitions were good. Perhaps too good. It seems to me this one has the edge on us. He sees and knows all, while we remain in the dark, as it were.
He swatted at a small white bat, which flitted too close, and the Ferenc's eyes went wide as he gave a small start and burst out.
His albinos! His bats! We should have known! That's how he tracks our course. The midges pursue us like fleas after a wolf cub.
Shaithas nodded sagely.
I have suspected as much. They're his minions, no less than Desmodus and his small black cousins were hours back on the star side. They scan our whereabouts and circumstances, reporting all back to whoever.
Arcus gaped and grasped his arm, drawing him to a halt.
You suspected these things and said nothing?
A suspicion is only a suspicion until it's an established fact,
Scythus answered, angrily shrugging away the other's restraining hand.
And anyway, it makes a very important point and gives us an insight into his circumstances.
Ah, insight, circumstances. What are you about? What point does it make?
Why, that the cone's master fears us. Bats to report our movements, a snowfall to hinder us, a sword-snouted creature guarding his hive, as the soldier bees of Sunside guard their honey. Oh, yes, he fears us, which in turn means he's vulnerable.
And to himself,
good reckoning, perhaps he really is. But still I'll take my chances with him. At least we have this much in common, our intelligence.
And at once, gurgling in Scythus's mind,
and our blood, my son. Don't forget our blood.
Again at once, the Ferenc snapped.
What?
His huge head swung around in Scythus's direction, and his eyes glared under gathering black brows.
What was that? Did you say or think something just then, Scythus?
Scythus hid his momentary panic behind bland innocence.
Nay?
He raised an eyebrow.
Say something? Think something? What's on your mind, Fess?
And as the Ferenc and Arcus scanned nervously all about, he sent a triple-shielded thought.
Twice you've almost given me away, Shaitan. Do you think this is a game? If there's so much as a hint of what I'm up to, I'm a goner.
The Ferenc scowled.
On my mind? No, nothing on my mind, except to get finished with this, that's all.
He straightened from his half-crouch.
So, what do you say? Do we go on, or do we call it a day? Is he vulnerable, this master of the volcano, or are we even more so? It's a nervy business, this climbing in the snow, not knowing what's waiting for us.
Shaitan came whispering into Scythus's mind.
Get on with it. Bring them in, bring them to me. Do it quickly, for he's no fool, this giant. He's sensitive, and we've both underestimated him. You'll need to watch him, and carefully.
I've noticed, said Scythus to the others almost conversationally, how the small albinos come and go from the west. So I say we stick to the ledge and see where it goes.
No, the Ferenc growled. Something's wrong, I'm sure of it.
Scythus looked at him, then at Arcus.
Do you wish to go down again? Have we wasted all our time and effort? Has a cloaking vampire mist entirely unnerved you? But our enemy wouldn't have issued it unless we had unnerved him.
Arcus said,
I'm with the Ferenc.
Scythus shrugged.
Then I go on alone.
Eh?
The Ferenc stared hard at him.
Then be sure you go to your death.
How so? Is this the place where Vols was taken?
No, that was on the other side, but...
Then I'll take my chances,
Arcus said.
Alone?
Scythus shrugged.
Which is worse, to die now or later? Better to do it here, I think, locked in combat, than locked in the ice with something drilling its way to my heart.
And then suddenly, as if he'd run out of patience, he hissed at both of them.
There are three of us, remember? Three great vampiric lords against what? An unknown being who quite obviously fears us almost as much as we, as you, fear him.
And he turned away from them.
Scythus,
the Ferenc called after him in a tone half angry, half admiring.
Enough,
Scythus snapped over his shoulder.
I'm done with you. If I win through, all is mine. And if I lose, well, at least I'll die as I've lived, vampiri.
He continued along the ledge and without looking back sensed the eyes of the two following him. Then,
we're with you,
came the Ferenc's final decision, but still Scythus stared straight ahead. And at last he heard Arcus's voice too, calling out,
Scythus, wait for us!
He did no such thing, but hurried on that much faster, so that now they must scramble to catch up. And with the pair hot on his heels, so he came upon the mouth of the first cave, even as Shaitan had forewarned. Here, because it would be expected of him, Scythus paused. Breathing heavily, the others saw the dark cavern entrance into which he had concentrated his gaze.
A way in, do you think?
Said Arcus, but none too eagerly. Scythus stared harder yet into the cave's gloomy interior, then made a show of carefully backing away from it.
Obviously so,
he said.
Perhaps too obviously.
And to the Ferenc.
What do you say, Fess? for it is amply apparent that the cold of these climes has focused our awareness to a fault. Is this a safe way to go on or not? Myself, I think not. It seems to me that far back in the cavern something stirs. I sense a thing of great bulk but limited intelligence, yet stealthy too.
Which was, of course, the Ferengh's own description of a sword snout. And, as Scythus had hoped might be the case, it put a picture of just such a creature into the giant's mind. Fess thrust forward his great head into the cave, glared into its depths and wrinkled his snout-like nose, and,
"Aye," he growled in a little while, "I sense it too, and indeed this could well be a way in, for the cone's master has guarded it with a blood beast."
Scythus nodded.
"Or maybe with the blood beast."
"Eh?"
said Arcas.
"Perhaps he is only the one creature," said Scythus. "For if there were a pair, then Fess here might well have been taken at the same time as Vols."
"But what does that matter now?" Fess shrugged. "Even on its own, this thing is a monster. Are you suggesting we might go against it?" "Madness! One of us would surely die, possibly two, even all of us, or at least end up sorely wounded before this thing succumbed. I saw it strike three times in as many seconds, unerringly, and ram Vols through and through like a fish on a traveller's spear. Why, he didn't even know what hit him."
But Scythus shook his head.
"No, I'm not proposing to take it on, quite the opposite. What I'm saying is this. If there's only one such beast, and it's here, then we go in by some other route."
"What?"
Arcas scowled.
"And they come thick and fast, these entrances and exits, do they?"
Scythus shrugged.
"So it would seem. The tunnel where Vols was taken, the cave you thought you saw back there on the lava cliff, this dark entrance here before us. Now listen, the master of the cone sent a mist to confuse us, didn't he? But not to keep us from this cave, not if this is where he stationed his sword snout. So perhaps there's another entrance close by."
He gave a sharp nod.
"I say we continue to follow the ledge a little way at least. Then, even if it comes to nothing, at least we'll have explored this part of the face to the full."
"Fair enough," said Ferengh. "No argument here, as long as you're not asking me to go in there."
Arcas growled.
"Then let's get on. We wasted time with all this talk and conjecture."
He started off in the lead, and the Ferengh followed on, and now Scythus brought up the rear. Overhead the small cloud had snowed itself out, the aurora writhed, and the stars gave the icy curve of the world's horizon a blue sheen. Scythus sensed the vampire awareness of his two companions, focused ahead, leaving him free to converse with Shaitan, and...
"There,"
he sent a high guarded thought.
"And how does this formation suit you? Also, what was the idea of the small snowstorm? I thought you were eager for them, yet there you are trying to fight them off."
The answer came back at once.
"First, your formation suits both of us very well. Second, the snow served to confuse and distract them, especially the giant. Now listen, and I'll describe your route from this point forward. Very soon now you'll come to a place where the rock is riven into deep crevices. One such crack has been filled with lava which forms a floor. Follow this and it will lead you direct to my abode at the Hollow Core. As for your companions, alas, their time runs very short. Indeed, they haven't enough of it to find their way here. Not on their feet, anyway."
There was nothing of humour in Shaitan's mental voice, only an icy resolve. Scythus made no further comment, and anyway, Arcas, heading the column, had come to a halt. Fess joined him, then Scythus. Before them, the surface of the ledge and the near-vertical face of the cliff were split into deep fissures a full pace in width. Arcas looked at the others.
"What now?"
"We go on," said Scythus.
Perhaps his reply had been too ready, or he had sounded too sure of himself, for the Ferengh looked at him for long moments, and at last the giant said,
"But the way looks like a jumble of broken rock. Any cave we find will surely have collapsed in upon itself."
"We won't know until we look," Scythus answered. "It's just that I feel we're very close now."
The Ferengh narrowed his eyes.
It appears I'm not the only one whose awareness has been focused to a fault. But very well, we press on. Arcus, lead the way.
The leper's son, muttering darkly to himself, stepped out across the first crack, teetered a little on the first side, and found his balance. And so they all proceeded. Then, after negotiating a half dozen more crevices,
"Ho!"
Arcus called back.
"But this next crack has a floor, formed of a frozen river of rock."
"An ancient lava run,"
said Fess, joining him. Scythus came last and looked at the cliff, riven where in olden times the flow had forced an exit.
"Lava from the secret heart of the volcano," he said. "Perhaps we've found our way in after all."
The Ferenc stepped under the cliff's overhang into the shadows of the cleft.
"Let me scan it."
Arcus went after him, with Scythus bringing up the rear, and they all three sniffed the air, probing the way ahead with keen vampire senses, until at last Arcus ventured,
"I sense nothing."
"Likewise,"
said Scythus, relieved that the small talented dire death had discovered no threat, where in fact he found the place menacing and uninviting to a fault. The Ferenc, however, seemed of a similar mind to Scythus, except he was perfectly and honestly willing to voice it.
"I don't like it," he gave his opinion, "for it smells too much like the cave where Vols got his."
"You've let Vols's death prey on your mind," Scythus told him. "And anyway, and as has been said before, forewarned is forearmed. Also, there are three of us this time. Arcus and I, we have our mighty gauntlets, and you have your even mightier talons. And in any case, we've already decided that the blood beast was hidden in that first cave. Myself,"
he paused to sniff the cave's air again,
"I think it's likely that the cone's master has worked some beguilement here. He has gloomed on this place and let the smell of death here. But a smell is only a smell, and I smell success. I'm for going in."
He looked from Fess to Arcus. Arcus shrugged.
"If this so-called cone master has comforts in there, then I'm with you, Scythus. I've had it to the tusks with hardship. I could use some rich red blood in my belly and a woman in my bed. Do you suppose it's a harem he guards so jealously?"
Scythus's turn to shrug.
"I've never been a one for the histories," he said, "but I've heard it said that some of the banished lords took their concubines with them. We can't say what we'll find until we find it."
"Comforts, I," said Ferenc, licking his lips. "I could use some of those myself. Very well, we go on."
Scythus put on a scowl and said,
"And how's this for a turn of events? Are you suddenly our leaders? It seems you like having the last word, Fess Ferenc. Arcus, you lead the way."
And,
"Very well, we go on."
"Bah," was Fess's retort. "If no one ever made a decision, then we'd be here forever. Here, let me lead the way."
Which was exactly what Scythus had wanted. The darkness of the interior was like daylight to the vampire lords. Indeed, it was preferable to the auroral light and the blue sheen cast by the stars. The Ferenc strode where the way was obvious and unobstructed, inched along where it was made obscure by jumbles, or where the uneven ceiling came down low, or where blisters of lava had burst to form jagged-rimmed, circular cusps of rock like small craters in the almost corrugated texture of the floor, and where other natural fissures or blowholes radiated from the main run, he steadfastly followed the ancient lava flow. Arcus stayed a pace or so to the Ferenc's rear, followed immediately by Scythus. As they progressed, so the oppressive sensation of ominous expectancy or foreboding lifted a little, while, to the dire death and the Ferenc at least, lent credence to Scythus's theory that the volcano's dweller had deliberately set a fearful aura over the mouth of the run to dissuade any would-be explorers. Scythus stayed very much on the alert, kept his thoughts fully guarded, would like to contact Shaitan but dared not. Not with Fess and Arcus probing in all directions with their minds, their vampiric awareness, sharp for the smallest hint of mental activity. And always they moved deeper into the heart of the rock. Eventually, the Ferenc called a halt, whispering,
"We must be halfway at least. Time to take stock."
"Of what?"
Arcus grunted. His blunt query sounded like an avalanche. echoing out and back in slowly decreasing waves of sound.
"Dolt!" Fess whispered again, when he could be heard. "What use to have the sense of bats to be able to smell out the way ahead like wolves and keep our minds tuned for the thoughts of others, when at every opportunity all you can do is make great noise? Would you alert your enemy to our presence?"
Abashed, Arcus kept his answer low.
"Hell, if he's at home, surely by now he knows we're coming."
"Perhaps," Scythus intervened. "But in any case, let's keep it quiet."
"Taking stock, yes," said Ferenc. "Going first all this way has taken the edge off my awareness. Arcus, you can spell me."
"No problem."
And the other took the lead, glad for the chance to make amends. But after moving only a dozen or so paces...
"Now hold," Arcus said. "Something's weird."
They had all felt it at the same time, a sensory void, a region vacant of all vibrancies, whether for good or evil, a place stagnant as some stirless, sunless subterranean lake. And they likewise knew what that meant, that the place had been made sterile, for even darkness and cold stone have a feel to them. Someone wanted them to believe that there was nothing, absolutely nothing here, because there was something here. Scythus's flesh tingled, and he knew the others must be feeling the same sensation. Arcus, in the lead, stood rooted to the spot, gurgling inarticulately, but it was much too late for gurgling anything. Scythus felt the heavy mental curtain deliberately ripped open, felt fear and horror springing into being behind it and rushing to burst through its tattered drapes, then saw the blur of leprous grey which was to be the end of Arcus Leperson called Dire Death, and indeed his death was dire. Where the thing came from would be hard to say. A niche in the wall of the place, a side tunnel, a hiding place in the lee of some bulge of lava. But it came at great speed and with fell intent, and it was exactly as Ferenc had described it. Patched white and grey, mottled like veined marble, it seemed to uncoil or erupt into being, as if some massive boulder half buried in the floor had come to life and reshaped itself. Its legs were a blur, claws scrabbling as it reared before Arcus. Its fish-like head bore a bone lance, tapered to a sharp point and equipped with thorns or hooks all along its length. Its eyes were like saucers, fixing its victim with their emotionless glare. Arcus's gauntlet was on his hand, ready, but as he raised his arm, the thing struck at him in a move too fast to follow. Its lance gashed his short, squat neck as its sword passed, and its needle-toothed jaw closed on his gauntlet arm. The arm was severed, swallowed at a gulp. In drawing back, the thing soared at Arcus's neck again and sliced into his whistling airpipe. In the next moment, its lance was rammed forward a second time, directly into him, piercing his squat body to the heart. He jerked and throbbed where he was held upright on the bone blade, and his tusks chomped on thin air, turning red as he coughed up a spray of blood. Fess whirled away from the scene. Scythus thought to run, and his eyes were huge and scarlet, but a lot more than simple fear lit them. There was fury too. The giant grabbed Scythus with one taloned hand and threw back the other like a bunch of black gleaming scythes.
"Treacherous bastard!" he snarled. "Your father's egg was rotten, and the pus is still in you."
"What?"
Scythus forced the metamorphic flesh of his hand to expand within his gauntlet.
"Are you mad?"
"In trusting you, I must be."
The Ferenc readied himself to thrust at Scythus, to punch in through his ribs with his taloned hand, grasp his living heart and wrench it out. But something stopped him, something he had seen behind Scythus. Chiton was the colour and texture of black lava. Only his movement against the rock splash wall had given him away, and only then because he wanted to be seen. Fess saw him, and his jaw fell open. He took a great gulp of air and forgot to strike at Scythus, who rewarded him by crashing his clenched gauntlet into the side of his head. Then Scythus's immemorial ancestor brushed him aside, out of the Ferenc's sudden loose grasp, and wrapped the stunned giant in a nest of lashing tentacles. With his arms locked to his sides, Fess was helpless, but in any case Scythus allowed no time for any sort of recovery. With a sound like tearing leather, His elastic mouth flowed over and closed upon Ferenc's entire face and head. Scythus, stumbling blindly away, struck stony debris and tripped, and suddenly nerveless, even Scythus nerveless, he crashed down onto the lava floor. To one side, Shaitan's nightmarish ingurgitator hissed and bubbled as it drained off the last of Arcus's fluids, and to the other, Fess Ferenc's invincible body pulsed and vibrated in the primal vampire's coils where Shaitan crushed and devoured his head. And Scythus thought,
"If there is a hell, then I stand at its gate!"
Shaitan's eyes glowed red out of the darkness, which was his crushing, grinding, metamorphic head. And his reply in Scythus's staggered mind was this:
"Aye, a hell of sorts, where we are the lords, for it is our hell, son of my sons, which one day will take with us to Starside, and then to all the worlds beyond."
Part 3. Chapter 1. The Hunters and the Hunted. Harry Keogh, Necroscope and would-be Avenger, had thought at first that it would not be especially difficult to track down his quarry. A young driver working for Frigis Express, who had happened to be a necromancer, sex monster, and the insane serial killer of to date 6 young women. But he'd soon discovered that it wouldn't be nearly as simple as he'd thought. Frigis had a dozen branches up and down the country, with a like number of warehouses and freezer depots, and over 200 trucks, of which 50% were on the roads at any given hour of the day or night. The firm must therefore employ quite a few drivers who would fit the vague description in Harry's possession. Vague, yes. For he suspected that the bloated, lusting creature he'd been shown was more a figure of terrified imagination than of a real man. Also, it seemed likely that Frigis would use casual labour, and it could be that Harry's man was one of these, but somewhere there should be a list of regular employees at least. Harry hoped to find that list, and also that John or Johnny he was looking for would be on it. On the third Wednesday in May, at 3:30 in the morning, he paid a visit to Frigis's main office in London to have a look at the company's books. He went there via the Mobius Continuum, making several stops at well-known exit points, before finally emerging in a shop doorway in Oxford Street. At that hour, the normally polluted air was almost wholly free of traffic fumes and even bracing, and the night lighting loaned the street a certain alien luminosity. Large, lethargically flapping pages from a discarded, dismembered newspaper fluttered like strange slow birds on buffets of blustery air along the gutters. The offices Harry was looking for were directly opposite. No lights showed within the building. He hoped there'd been no night watchman to complicate matters, and there wasn't. Entering the building by the Mobius route, Harry let his burgeoning vampire instincts guide him to the correct floor and then to the records office. Locked doors were no trouble at all to the Necroscope, who used numbers to conjure doors of his own out of the thin air. But twice, purely out of habit, he went to switch on lights before realizing that he no longer had need of them. And once he came face to face with a full-length mirror, which both shocked and fascinated him with its picture of a gaunt-faced man with luminous, red-tinged eyes. He had known, of course, that the change was taking place in him, but only then realized how quickly it was happening. It filled him with mixed emotions and alien longings. It was the night and the mystery and the going in strange places, as if in search of prey. Well, and so he was. Except there is prey, and there is prey. The records office was dirty and untidy, and smelled of strong coffee and stale cigarette smoke. It had an antiquated system of filing cabinets, all open for Harry's inspection. He quickly turned up a list of branch and depot managers, but no information on rank and file employees. There was, however, a list of addresses and telephone numbers of all Frigis Express's subsidiary offices, which Harry pocketed. That should save him a little time at least. And that was all there was, which was hardly satisfactory. Disgruntled, Harry pondered over his next move, presumably to start at the top of the list of branches and work down it. But then, out of nowhere, he found himself wondering if maybe Trevor Jordan was up and about. He could use a cup of coffee, a little companionship and friendly conversation, someone to be with, briefly anyway, if only to work the weirdness out of his system. It was unlikely Jordan would be awake, but just on the off chance, Harry reached out with his telepathic mind and searched for him, and immediately found him.
Harry?
Jordan's unmistakable voice sounded in Harry's mind, as clearly as if he'd whispered the words in his ear.
Is that you?
Harry found telepathy similar to and yet quite different from deadspeak. He had used something like it before, a sort of reverse deadspeak, he supposed, but that had been quite a few years ago in his incorporeal days and also very different. Telepathy was therefore new to him. Even so, still, it struck him as being more natural. Well, and he supposed it was more natural, for after all, almost anything in the world would be. But telepathy, it was something like a telephone conversation, even down to the hiss and crackle of psychic static, whereas deadspeak was the wind whistling eerily down a bleak desert canyon under a full floating moon. In short, it was the difference between talking mind to mind with living people and conversing metaphysically with dead ones. And yet Jordan had seemed wary, unsure of Harry's identity, and even unwilling to reveal his own. Just why that should be, the necroscope couldn't guess. He frowned and asked, "Who else would it be, Trevor?" And hearing his voice, Jordan knew him at once. But his mind's sigh of relief warned Harry that something was very wrong. Likewise, what he said next.
"Harry, you know my old place in Barnet? That's where I am, but I can't stay for long. I'd like to get out of here. I don't want to explain right now. It mightn't even be safe to. But do you think you could get round here? I mean, like now?"
"What's the trouble?" Harry was switched on now, alert to danger, and he could still sense Jordan's uncertainty.
"Harry, I don't know. I came to London to see if I could maybe find something out for you, but I've been blocked all along the line, almost from the start. I came here to watch them, E Branch, but hell, I didn't think there'd be anyone watching me."
"Right now?"
"Right now, yes."
"I'm on my way," said Harry. Air made a small implosion into the empty space where he stepped through a Mobius door, its draft causing papers to rustle in a filing cabinet he'd left standing open. But before the papers had stopped rustling, Harry had tracked down Jordan's thoughts to Barnet. He emerged silently into the resurrected telepath's front room, whose first-floor bay windows overlooked a cobbled cul-de-sac, the end wall of a park, and the dark, gently mobile silhouette of trees beyond. The room was in darkness, and Jordan was at the window, looking out through a crack in the curtains on a street shining dull yellow in electric lamplight. Harry reached out to a wall switch and put on the light, and Jordan hissed, fell into a couch, and whirled to face him. There was a gun in his hand.
"It's okay," the necroscope told him. "It's just me."
Jordan drew a deep breath and almost fell into a chair. He waved his hand to indicate Harry should also sit down.
"It's just the way you come and go," he said.
"You invited me," Harry reminded him. Jordan nodded.
"Here I am, a bag of nerves, looking out into the street, and then the light going on like that."
Harry said, "It wasn't deliberate, or rather it was. If I had spoken, you'd have turned and seen me. I'm not sure which would have shocked you more, the light going on suddenly or seeing my eyes in the dark."
"Your eyes?"
Harry grimaced, nodded. "They're red as hell, Trevor, and there's nothing going to stop it now. What's in me is a strong one,
but you still have a little time."
Harry shrugged. "I don't know how long. Long enough to do one last thing, I hope, and then I'll be on my way." He finally sat down. "Now, would you like to put your gun away and tell me what's on your mind?" Jordan looked at the gun in his hand as if he'd forgotten it was there. He gave a snort and replaced it in his shoulder holster.
"Nervous as a cat," he explained, "or rather as a mouse watched by a cat."
"Are you watched?" Harry didn't know where to aim his thoughts to check. Searching for Jordan had been different, for he'd known what he was looking for. Likewise Paxton. But looking for someone he wasn't used to, some unknown someone, was a trick he'd yet to master. "Are you sure?" Jordan got up and put on the light, went to the curtains again. "I've never been so sure. He or they are out there right now, not too far away, scanning me. Or if not scanning, obscuring. They're blocking me. I can't read past them. I keep thinking it can only be E Branch. But how the hell would they know I was back? Alive, I mean." He looked back from the curtains, saw Harry's alien face and said, I see what you mean. Harry, a tall, dark silhouette whose eyes made his face a mask from hell, nodded. But there were other things to worry about than the glare of his blood-hued eyes. "What does it feel like to have someone watching you, blocking your mind?" "Being watched is how it felt with Paxton. Blocking is mental interference, a screen of static. But I wasn't even sure Paxton was there until you told me. He was just an itch. And as for mental interference..." "Okay," the other matched Harry's shrug. "I'll give you an example. Try aiming your thoughts right at me." Harry did it and met a buzzing wall of interference. If he hadn't known it was Jordan, then he wouldn't know what it was. Jordan said, "Find something like that, and you know someone's scrambling you. Deliberately. I know because I've had practice. When the Russian espers used to cover the Chateau Brunitzi, it was like this all the time. We used to try and break through, and they were always trying to get through to us." He looked at Harry again, penetratingly. "Incidentally, you do it all the time, Harry, except when you're wanting to read someone or wanting someone to read you. But with you it's different. Something that's permanent and getting stronger all the time. It isn't static, but something else, and it comes natural to you. So natural you didn't even know about it, did you? Or maybe natural is a wrong word for it. What you have is, well, in E Branch we used to call it mind smog." The necroscope nodded. "I'd wondered about that. It's a dead giveaway, but now Darcy's espers must know what I am, or if not he should fire the lot of them. So it looks like the talent Wellesley gave me is going to be redundant. Or maybe not." And after a moment's thought, "No, definitely not. Wellesley's thing is a total blanket. It doesn't just make my mind unreadable, but blanks it out entirely. The vampire thing is just mind smog, like you said. But it makes me wonder, how come Paxton didn't discover what was happening to me earlier? How was he able to get to me at all?" "It was only just starting then," Jordan answered. "Your vampire thing wasn't fully developed. It still isn't, but sufficiently so it stopped me. I've tried to reach you half a dozen times this last couple of days, but was only able to make it when you wanted to contact me. Oh, and something else. You mentioned Darcy Clark, right? Well..." Suddenly he paused and held up a cautioning hand. "Wait!" And in another moment, "Did you feel that?" Harry shook his head. "A probe," said Jordan. "Someone trying to get into me. The moment I relax, they're there." Harry stepped towards Jordan and the large curved windows, but held himself back a little in the shadows. "You said it was on your mind to get out of here. What did you mean?" "Only that I don't know what's on their minds," the other told him. "I mean, I know it can only be E Branch out there, but I don't know what they're up to or what they're planning. Do they know it's me?" "That seems unlikely. What, that I'm back from the dead? But on the other hand, and from their point of view, who else can I be if I'm a telepath using Trevor Jordan's flat? And this watch they're keeping on me, it reminds me of that time we were covering Julian Badescu. I mean, who the hell do they think I am, Harry?" Very slowly, Harry nodded. "I'm beginning to understand," he said, and he gripped Jordan's elbow. "And you're right. It's exactly like that time they were covering Julian Badescu, which means that it's not so much a case of who they think you are, but what they think you are." Jordan gasped. "You mean they think I'm a..." "It's possible. You're back from the dead, aren't you?" "But I have no mind smog."
"Neither did I, until recently."
Again Jordan's gasp.
"They're wanting to see how things develop before they move in. Which would explain just about everything, certainly would explain why I'm shit scared of them. I'm picking up something of their suspicions, their intentions.
I'm sensing the hunters hot on my track. Harry, they think, they suspect that I'm a vampire. The necroscope tried to calm him down. But you're not, and it's easy to prove that you're not. Also, Darcy Clark is in charge of E-Branch, and what were you going to tell me about Darcy anyway? Jordan came away from the window. Another look at Harry's face convinced him the light would be better on. He tripped the switch on the wall, then sat down heavily. Darcy's at home, he said, and very unhappy about something. He was the one I was supposed to be watching, remember? Because he's the boss and would know which way things were jumping. But now he seems to have been taken off the job. And while he isn't a telepath himself, still somebody is throwing up a pretty good shield around him, making it hard to get anything. That felt ominous. Harry said, maybe we should go and see him. Maybe we should confront him, ask him straight out what's going on. I'm pretty sure I know already that the branch is just waiting for me to put a foot wrong, but if we hear it from Darcy, then we'll know it for sure. Jordan shrugged. At least it would get me out of here. I feel that if I don't get out of here, I'll go nuts. God, I don't like being watched and not knowing what they're thinking. Okay, said Harry. And afterwards? Will you go back here or what? The thing is, I could use some help on this serial killer thing, and we can use my place in Bonnyrigg as a base, for the time being anyway. That way we'll be able to spell each other watching out for the Watchers. And when this task I've set myself is done, then, before I leave, I mean before I really leave everything, we'll find a way to square it with E-Branch and put your own record straight. That all sounds good to me. Jordan breathed a sigh of relief. Just say the word, Harry, and I'm your man. The other nodded. The word is we go and see Darcy. He's single, isn't he? Like most of your Espers. I know he used to live in Hoddesdon. Is he still there? And will he be on his own, or is there a woman? Darcy isn't likely to buckle under a shock or two, I'm sure, but I don't want to go scaring any women. Jordan shook his head. No women that I know of. Darcy's been married to the job too long, but he's not in Hoddesdon anymore. He got himself a house in Crouch End just a mile or two away. A nice place with a garden in Hallismere Road. Only been there a couple of weeks. He moved in right after the Greek job. Again, Harry's nod. I don't know the area, but you can show it me. Is there anything else you want to take with you? My suitcase is already packed. Then we can go right now. At 4:20 in the morning, if you say so. I don't have a car, though, so we either walk or I'll need to call a... But Jordan knew his mistake at once, as soon as he saw Harry's strange wan smile. A taxi is not necessary, the necroscope told him. I have my own transport. Darcy Clark was still up, pacing the floor as he'd paced it all night. It wasn't his talent that was bothering him. He himself wasn't in any danger. He was just worried about the branch and the job he suspected was being planned right now at this very moment. About that and about Harry Keogh. But in fact, the two were one and the same thing. The ground floor lights of Clark's house were bright behind a facade of shrubs and trees as Harry guided Jordan out through a Mobius exit and back into the real world. You can open your eyes now, he told the telepath, as Jordan staggered under the briefly suspended, now renewed, pull of gravity. It was like the feeling in the pit of your stomach when an elevator descends to the level you want and jerks to a halt there, except this elevator had no walls, floor, or ceiling, and you fell in every direction at once, which was why Harry had asked Jordan to close his eyes a moment. My God! Jordan whispered, swaying a little as he looked all around at the night street. Harry thought, God, Mobius Continuum. Well, and you could be right. August Ferdinand thinks so anyway. He steadied the telepath and said, I know. It's a weird sensation, isn't it? Jordan looked at Harry and felt himself in awe of him. He talked about the immundane, the utterly unbelievable, as if it were merely odd. But finally Jordan gathered his senses to say, Nice shot, Harry. That's Darcy's place right there. They let themselves in through the garden gate and walked up a path between the shrubs. The glowing white globe of a lamp drew a cloud of moths where it hung like a small moon over the front door. Harry directed Jordan to stand to one side, put on his dark glasses, and pushed the doorbell. In a little while, footsteps sounded from within.
The door was equipped with a peephole lens. Clark used it and saw Harry standing on his doorstep, staring right at him. His talent made no objection as he opened the door, which told him a lot.
"Harry," he said, "come in. How are you?"
"Darcy," Harry said, taking hold of his arm, "listen, take it easy, but there's someone with me."
"Someone with?"
Darcy started to say as Jordan stepped into view. He saw him and said,
"Trevor?"
Then he started violently and took a pace to the rear. Harry, following him in, said,
"It's okay, it's okay."
"Trevor!"
Clark breathed, his eyes bulging in his suddenly pale face.
"Trevor Jordan? Oh, my God! Oh, sweet Jesus!"
Harry wished people wouldn't keep using these names of power so casually, but on this occasion he understood and made nothing of it. Trevor Jordan pushed past Harry and took Clark's other arm. Clark at once strained back and away from both of them, but again it was a normal reaction, nothing to do with his talent. Jordan said,
"Darcy, it really is me, and I'm okay."
"Okay?"
Clark's mouth opened and closed, and the word came out like a croak. He tried again.
"Really you? Yes, I can see that. But I know you're dead. I saw you in that Rhodes Hospital, remember, when you put a bullet to your brain."
Harry said, "Can we go inside? Sit down, talk."
"Talk?"
Clark looked at him, at both of them, as if they were mad, or as if he was, but then he nodded.
"Sure, why not? And then I might wake up."
In the living room,